Test. Okay, where were you born, Ronnie? Why don't you start there?
Well, I was born, I reckon, well, Sutton's a county seat. I reckon you just say born in Sutton. I was born on a farm about, I suppose, 3 miles out of Sutton, on Elk River. I was born on Elk River.
Were you born at home?
Hmm?
Were you born at home then? That'd be 3 miles upstream from Sutton.
Hmm?
3 miles upstream from Sutton?
Yeah.
And Sutton was the post office?
Yeah.
And you, your mother died when you were pretty young.
Yeah.
What? How old were you?
About 10 years old or something like that.
What did you do there at home? Was it a farm?
Yeah, we had a farm, small farm. We farmed. My father worked in lumber woods about all of his life. And we farmed too.
Keep stock?
Yeah, we had stock. We had horses, hogs, milk cows. Just the usual stuff that you would keep on the farm. We, always never kept, you know, but a few head of cattle at a time.
Did your father worked in the woods, did he have to live off at camps, or did he mostly live at home?
He lived at home. He stayed at home. He he always had his own timber job. Yeah, he would buy a track of timber, and he never owned his own sawmill, but he'd buy a track of timber, and he had a fellow that did his sawing for him all the time. And when they'd saw out one track, why, he'd shop around till he found another track of timber, and he'd buy it, and this fellow would move in and saw it for him. And he sold a lot, he cut and sold a lot of telephone poles and electric poles. At one time, about all the poles that was used in this area, he cut for the West Penn, for the Monongahela Power, whatever you want to call them, and the Bell Telephone. And they would just give him an order of how many poles they wanted and where they wanted them put, delivered to, what point, what place they wanted them took, and he would take them there. And he made a lot of cross ties. He shoot cross ties, and he sold them, of course, to the B&O. And he also cut pulpwood, such like.
What kind of timber did they cut for poles?
For electric poles and telephone poles, chestnut only. Chestnut only. And when the chestnut timber all died, well, they could get no more poles in this part of the country, so they started getting these creosote pine poles.
And you say that you started work helping your father?
Yeah. Yes, Albert. He took me in the woods when I was 10 years old. He would put me on the lower side of the log. They'd, usually those timber cutters would cut timber slants ways. They wouldn't cut it straight down the hill. They'd cut a slants way so the top would fall over there, and they'd have to keep the center of the swath so they could skid the logs out without messing up with brace. And but they would cut them slunts ways, and he'd put me on the lower side of the log so he could pull us all back to him, and it'd almost go downhill. You know, all I had to do about was keep it straight. And when he cut the log down to where there was danger of dropping off, well, he'd tell me to get on the upper side of the log. I'd climb across it, get on the other side of the log, on the upper side. Then he'd take the handle off the saw from my end of the saw, and he would saw that out the rest of the way off with one handle, and until the log dropped off. I know when first time I remember him putting me on the lower side of the log and tip him saw a tree, I was scared to death because I had watched him cut timber, and I knew what the logs did when they were sawed off. They'd roll down the hill, and I was scared to death, but of course he knew all of that too. But when you get down there to where it was getting down where it might, if it happened to be laying up a little off the ground where it might break off, why, that's what he'd do. He'd tell me to get on the upper side of the log, and I would, and he'd take the handle off and finish cutting it off.
One time he told me something about you were making a crossing across the river. I think you said with your brother and your father on a horse or something.
Yeah, me and my brother, and the horse fell. Yeah, we went to, we was going to log that day, and we had a marker in the river that if that log that had a limb stuck up on it, and if that limb was covered, it was too much water to ford the river with the horses. But if that limb was showing, we could ford it. So this morning the water was just barely over that limb. And he said that he just put in our hat to get a certain amount of work done. He was behind, and we'd try to ford it anyway. So we got about halfway across this shoulder. I expect where this stretch was, where we crossed it, I expect was approximately 4 miles from my pond, I reckon. I'd say about approximately 1,000 feet across where we had to ford. We had to go kind of slouch ways across, and we got about middle ways of that. And our horse, one of me and my brother was on, fell. And my father had his timber axe, and he was leading on the other horse. And he threw his axe. He always kept his axe razor sharp. And he threw his axe as far as he could throw it out to one beyond the horse, and jumped off the horse and came to us. By the time he got off the horse, when our horse fell, well, we just floated off the horse like a couple light bulbs, and was floating down the river. But I grabbed my brother. I was a little bit taller than he was, and I could just touch the bottom with the tips of my toes, just enough to keep me from going under. And I held him up. But I didn't have no power against the water to go anywhere. We was going down the river, and there was a big swirl hole right at the foot of the shoal, which was about approximately another 1,000 feet downstream. And he got to us in time to get us, and my father was a tall man. He was over 6 foot. And he waited and got us to shore. And the horse that we was on was floating on downstream, and he would have gone in that swirl hole and would have drowned. And my father thought maybe he might be tangled in the harness some way. And he called to him, and the horse got up on his feet and came out to the bank. And the one that he was riding just stood there and never went nowhere, just stood there in the middle of that river and nickered and pawed the water and just carried on. And so when we got kind of got us straightened up there, while he called to the other one, and she came out to the bank, and so nobody got actually got hurt. And so that evening when we quit work, why, my father put me and my brother on the two horses, and he said, "You're supposed to go around Besetting." That was about a 5-mile trip to go around and cross the bridge down to Besetting and back up on our side of the river. He didn't try to ford it anymore when the water was that stage. Of course, he forded it many a time after that, but not, he never took no more chances on that water, that amount of water when that limb was covered. Why, he stayed out of it.
Back when you were a boy, you must have been lots of people fording the river all over, you know, up and down the
river. Oh yeah, it was a regular ford for the whole community. Everybody crossed the river there. They rode across, they also drove horses and wagons across there. They hauled even loads of lumber and such like across the river, or whatever freight they needed to haul, and had to go to the opposite side of the river. Well, that's where they went across.
Did you ever hear of anybody getting drowned on?
No, nobody ever got drowned there that I know of. But
were up and down the river any when you were a boy?
Yes, there was people got drowned. There was a fellow, I can't remember that fellow's name, but there was a fellow drowned upstream I'd say probably about 3 miles upstream from there. There was a fellow drowned. He was a floating what they call a set of gunnels. They would cut down trees, poplar trees, and hew them out like a cross tie. Only they would be about 50, 60 feet long, maybe some of them even longer than that. And they were all in one piece, and they would just hew them out like a cross tie. They call them gunnels. They used them in building barges. And they would float them to Charleston. That was the market they had for them. And that's where he was headed for, was Charleston. It was getting late in the evening. And there was one spot just downstream a little ways, and my great-grandfather was out on the river bank when the fella came along. And of course, he was floating down the river, but it was floating slow. It was in dead like water. When they'd come to those shoals where they were rough, well, of course they traveled fast. But in between the shoals, what we called eddies, why your raft or whatever you had wouldn't move very fast. And he hollered at the fella, and he told him his first trip down the river. And he told him he'd better be careful, it was a very dangerous place right ahead of him. And he started to tell him how to hit that current to keep him washing into a certain rock that was down about middle ways of this rough water, and would tear his gunnels up and maybe throw him off in the river. And he told my great-grandfather that he didn't know the stream too well, but he didn't thank no man for any advice. And he went on down there, and he hit this rock just where my great-grandfather was trying to tell him it was dangerous. And he hit that rock and tore his gunnels apart and threw him off, and he drowned. And they found him all over a week afterwards. They had to wait till the water went down. When the water went down, they found him. There was an islet about a mile below where he tore his gunnels up, where he was thrown in the river. About a mile below, there was an island. And that island had grown up, all those islands grown up in brush and trees and stuff, because the water didn't overflow them often enough to keep them killed out, and they'd grow. And there's quite a bit of trees, nothing big, small trees on that island, and they found him drifted up against one of them trees after the water went down. His name was Gibson. Gibson was his name.
So that was Saul Carpenter, your great-grandfather. Your great-grandfather, that was Saul Carpenter. Saul Carpenter?
Saul.
Told him to watch. Well, who was it then that killed the elk?
That was Jeremiah. That was my great-grandfather.
Do you want to talk about that?
Well, he lived at that time, somewhere, I don't know exact spot. Some of them lived at the mouth of Laurel Holly, and some of them lived up just below Centralia, just below the mouth of Laurel Creek. I think that's where he lived at that time. And he started hunting one morning, and he ran across this elk track. And of course, it's like tracking anything else. The bigger the track, the bigger you figured the animal was. And he came back to the house. It was headed downstream. And he came back to the house and told his wife that he had saw this large elk track, and he said he was going to follow it downstream. He didn't know how far he'd have to go, and he said if he wasn't back by dark, not to be uneasy about him, because he was going to follow the elk till he found it. Well, he walked all that day, followed it all that day, and he never caught up with it until just almost dark. And he came to the just opposite the island that was about a quarter of a mile from where I was raised, from our old home place. It was a big island. And he looked across on the point of this island, and it was laying over there on that island, on the point of that island. It had went over there and laid bedded down for the night. Well, it was dark, too dark to shoot. And he thought he would shoot, take a chance on it. And he thought, well, he better not. He better just lay down and be quiet and wait till morning. And he started to do that. And then he thought, well, if that elk gets wind of me anytime during the night, or I happen to make any noise at all, well, it'll be gone in the morning. So I'm going to shoot, hit or miss. And he did. He couldn't see the sights on his gun, but he just pointed the gun over to the elk and aimed the best he could and fired, and the elk never got up. He killed it. And he went over then to the elk, and there wasn't anything he could do, only just stay there. So he stayed there that night. The next morning, it was the point of the island was up where the elk was up off the above the water, or it was, oh, I don't know, probably 6 or 8 feet above water. And he rolled it off in the water, off that knoll there where it was laying, off in the water, and floated it across there, drug it across in the water, across there to a little bar, little rock bar. And he cleaned it up there, skinned it, and he went out and he cut hickory poles, made bows to put that hide around, and he stretched that hide around them bows and made him a canoe-shaped thing out of it, and cut up the meat and piled it in that, and waited and pulled that canoe hide back home. When he killed the elk and then when he took it over there, he knew he had to clean it up, because he couldn't go off and leave it. If he did, Indians might come along and steal it while he was gone, or if they didn't do that, why, there's a chance he'd hide out and kill him when he come back with help. And so he just did the whole job while he was there and took it with him.
And you think, you've told me before, you think maybe that's how Elk River, they came to start calling it Elk River?
Hmm?
You've told me before, you think that's when they came to start calling it Elk River?
Oh, yes. Yeah, that it didn't have no name at that time. A fella called me, was gonna trying to get some stuff together. He was gonna write some on it, and he said something about it. And I said, "Well, I can tell you, what who named Elk River." I said, "My great grandfather, Jeremiah Carpenter." And I said, "Dave." I said, "You've been to that island, been around it many a time," and I said, that's why they called it the Buck Elk Island, because that's where he killed the elk. And everybody knew the Elk Island, the Buck Elk Island, wherever it was mentioned. By, if anybody had ever been in that part of the country, they knew what she was talking about. And
now, How did you hear that story? Did you hear that story from your grandfather? Or?
Yeah, I've heard my grandfather tell it many a time. Yeah.
Let's get back to your life, Ernie. When you started to work early in the woods, and did that take you out of school a lot too?
Oh yes, yeah. That's why I never got to go to school. Yes. It took me out of school. There's six of us kids when my father, when my mother died, and my father figured if he could get along with what help I could give him, why, it saved him hiring somebody. So it meant that much more for the family, and it was that tough in them days, and. At the same time, not realizing really what it was going to mean to me in later years. But we stuck together. He kept us all together. We wasn't scattered around all over the country like happens in a lot of cases like that. He kept us together until we got big enough to go on our own. And he lived the latest years of his life. He lived with Mabel and I after we got married. By he lived with us, but the girls had all got married and left, and my brother and my younger sister and my dad and I, we stayed there for a good many years. We had a timber job not too far from the house, and I'd get up in the morning, and my younger sister was only about 6 years old, I reckon. She just started school. But she'd help me what she could in the kitchen. We'd get breakfast, and I'd help her and my brother get off to school, and I'd go to the woods with my father. And I'd work till about 11 o'clock. I'd come in and fix he and I a little bite to eat, and he'd come in and eat, and we'd go back to the woods together and work till about 4 o'clock, and I would come in and start fixing supper. And when they came home from school, well, of course, they'd help me. We'd fix supper. My father, he'd work till about 6 or 7 o'clock, and he'd come in. And that's the way we went there for a long time. And then...
So you never left home when you got married?
No, I had went to Clarksburg and had been working down there, I don't know, probably well on to a year before Mabel and I got married. And I'd come home about once a month. I'd come oftener than that if I could, but most of the time that's about as often as I got home, about once a month. I'd come home, and he stayed there, he and my younger sister and my brother, they stayed there after I went away and went to work. Why, they still stayed there at the old home place and, together. And well, we all stayed there together until we married off. I mean, after I was married, why, then her and I lived in Clarksburg a while, and I got laid off, and that's back there in times when they were pretty tough, and I didn't get back to work, so you couldn't live in town if you wasn't working, so we moved back home. And so we all lived there, Mabel and I, and my father, and my brother, and younger sister. We lived there for several years until they got grown up and married off. And then my father, Mabel and I still lived there on the old home place. My father lived there with us until he passed away. And we continued to live there. And finally, I went back to work at Clarksburg. I had I stayed at boarded at my sister's down there, and stayed down there. When I went back to work, though, I went to work at another factory. I used to work at the Roland Dash factory, and when I went down and got to work again, why, I went to work for Pittsburgh Plate. Uh-huh. It was a lot bigger factory, and I never lost too awful much time.
What was the first place, Roland?
Hmm?
What was the first?
Roland Glass Factory.
Roland Glass. And about what year did you get down to Clarksburg to work there?
Oh, I think I first went down there in 29, somewhere along there. And it was in the fall, and I'm not really sure about that, whether it was in fall or early winter, but it was up in, I think maybe early winter of 29. And the following July, Mabel and I was married.
So you went up to Clarksburg and worked at that Roland?
I worked there 38 years at the Pittsburgh Plate, and I worked something over a year at the Roland.
You worked at Roland for a year, and then you came back home?
Yeah, I was laid off. They went down, shut down, they was down, didn't do nothing. They didn't run a tap for about 2 years after they shut down. And by the time they got going again, because they was putting men back to work, you know, I got a job at the Pittsburgh Plate, so I worked there from that time on. I retired. I worked at the Pittsburgh Plate for 38 years.
Sometime in there, you got called in service, didn't you?
Yeah, I went to service while from work. I was still working when I went to service. And, after I came out of the service, of course, during the First World War, you know, if you left a job and went in the service, when you come back, somebody else had that job. But our wonderful Roosevelt, he took care of that. He knew what happened, and he said, your jobs will be waiting for you when you come back. There might be another man on it, but he'll move over. So when I came back, my job was there, and I went back to work. And every other man did that left his job and went into service. And
how long had you been married when you went into service? How long had you been married when you went into service?
Well, 12, 11 years.
And did you have to go overseas?
No, I wasn't overseas. I was just in the States.
Was Mabel with you, or did Mabel always
stay? No, she stayed.
West Virginia?
She stayed at home for a while, and then she went down to Clarksburg and stayed with my younger sister down there until I came out of service. She worked in a store there.
So that was while you were working for Pittsburgh Plate that you were in the service, and then you came back and got your old job back at Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I was working there before I went in the service. I went to work at Pittsburgh Plate in 1933, and I all worked there for quite a little while, and I was laid off. In them days, they would just hit spells that their business would be pretty good, and of course they would hire whatever men that they needed, and then when business let up, why, of course they had to lay them off. And I went out there one hitch there for a good many months. I'd go out there and work, and they'd give me a layoff slip that evening and say, come back out tomorrow and get your money. I'd go back out the next day after my money, and they'd say, no, we ain't going to pay you. Come on out to work tomorrow. I'd come back out the next day, and that evening they'd give me a layoff slip. Come out tomorrow and get your money. I'd go out the next day, and they wouldn't give it to me. They'd say, oh, come on out to work tomorrow. Something would come up that they could still use me, and they'd call me back out. And they did that there for days and days at their one time. Finally, they did lay me off, and I was off quite a little while. I'd been off from work when I went in the service about a month. I'd been laid off for about a month, and just had got back to work when I got my call to come in the service.
How old a man were you when you got drafted?
I was in my early 30s.
So then, off and on, you worked at Pittsburgh for 38 years?
Mm-hmm.
And then, when did you come back to Braxton County to stay?
We came back up here, what was it, 72?
You can talk, Mabel, that's okay.
Is it a problem?
No.
No. Oh. I got blew up here. I think so. I think it was about 72 when we came back here to live. We're good. We're doing that for me. Your eyes being as quiet as a mouse. Well, let's talk about your music a little bit, Ernie. You started playing when you were about how old?
Oh, I fooled around with the fiddle maybe when I was about, 12 years old, but I never gave a thought that I could learn to play a fiddle. I was crazy about music. I loved the fiddle as far as I was concerned, any kind of music. But I don't know, somehow or other, I reckon didn't have any confidence and myself. And when my father would get the pedal down and play, why, I would pick it up. When he would lay it down, I would pick it up and saw Bo across a little bit. But it seemed like that I just couldn't get any two notes to match, and I'd soon lay it down. But when I really began to get serious about it, I was, I don't know, probably 14 or somewhere along there. And but I didn't. We just went along there for a long time, and we never went out any place. We just all gone backward, and we never went no place. Nobody even knowed it when we even began to play a few tunes. Nobody knowed anything about it, and because we wasn't about to play for anybody. So went along there, and as we learned a little more, why, my father, he just quit playing himself and just turned the music over to us. Of course, he never did play anything but the fiddle. So my brother, he started playing the fiddle too. And so finally, my sister got interested in the banjo, and she got to pull around the banjo, and pretty soon she was playing the banjo a little bit. And my brother said, well, if you could find him an old guitar, he'd see if he could learn to second on the guitar, and then we'd have a three-piece outfit. And so we did that. We traded up an old guitar somewhere. I don't remember now where, but anyway, it wasn't very long till the three of us was, before we could actually take a tune and play it completely through while we was playing together. What little bit we played together. And my father gave us all the encouragement that he possibly could, because he was very much interested in us playing music, and he wanted us to keep at it. And so after a while, we began to get a whole tune, and another one, and another one, and we went from there. We wasn't very long till we was out playing around for dances and parties and so forth. We didn't have no automobile, of course, and wherever we went, why, we walked. We walked different times, as much as a 20-mile trip to and back home. Wouldn't get in till the chickens was crowing the next morning.
Was there any time during your lifetime that you stopped playing music for any length of time?
Did I stop?
Yeah,
I didn't. I hadn't played too much before I went into service, and then, of course, while I was in the service, I didn't get a chance to play. And when I came back, I'd kind of got away from it. I hadn't played any for so doggone long, and I went back on the job, and I was in debt when I went in the service, and I was in debt a lot more when I came out of the service, and I wanted to get my bills paid as fast as I could, and I went back to work. And when I'd come in of an evening, I said, all going tired, I couldn't play. So I went along for about, I expect, probably 20 years that I didn't play any. And of course, before I went into service, well, my sister had got married, and my brother was married and gone. And but I'd been playing, keeping in practice, you know, just playing the fiddle at home before I went into service. But like I say, when I came back, I hadn't played for so long, and I just kind of got away from it. And so I worked every bit of overtime I could get. Sometimes I wouldn't get in till midnight. Sometimes the next morning, I went out at 7 o'clock in the morning and come back in the next morning about that time. And so I got my fiddle hat linen up in the clothes closet and up in the shelf. One day I was there and around the house, and I happened to think about it, and I thought, well, my goodness, I haven't looked at that beetle for a long time. I went and got it, took it out of the case, and it was nothing but just a ball of mold. It was mold, just white mold all over it, from one end to the other end. And scared me to death, because I was just sure it would come apart. So I got me some towels and stuff and cleaned it up. Got everything off, all of it I could, and checked it over, and I didn't see any places it was loose. And I cleaned the case all out, put it in another place where it wouldn't, where it would stay good and dry, where it wouldn't get damp enough to mold. And so I finally, I'd come up home, and they was, at that time they was having music down here at this little country store down here at Lowell Fork. They'd gather in on Saturday nights and play music there in that little store. I'd stop there to hear them. And as soon as I went in, well, of course, there'd always be somebody in there that knew that I used to play, and they'd start hollering for me to come over and play. I wouldn't do it. And so it went on and on and on and on for a long time, and finally they did get me to pick up the fiddle down there one night, and my goodness, I couldn't do nothing with it. It was worse than when I first started learning to play. I just forgot about all I ever knew, what little I did. And so it kind of worried me, and I thought, my goodness, I probably was like a lot of people who quit. I thought probably whenever I got ready to play, all I had to do was just pick up a fiddle and start playing. But you lay off from it that long, and you just about got to learn over. So that's just what I did. And another thing that kind of helped me get started back, there was a props boy. Lived over in the Centrini country someplace. He was a real good fiddler. And he was working away somewhere, and he'd come home about every Saturday night. And he traveled that road, and he would stop in there and play music with them people down there. And one tune in particular that he played that I was determined I was going to learn that tune, something like he played, Golden Slippers. I thought he played it awful good, better than the most of people I'd ever heard play it. And I sort of kind of took a liking to the way he played that tune, and I was determined I was going to learn to play that tune, something like he did. I played the Golden Slippers, all right, used to, but not like he did. So I went to work on the doggone thing, and I put in quite a bit of time on that, and by the time I began to get it, like he played it, why, of course, I'd been sawing on some of the other tunes, and that's the way I got started back. And, yeah, there was several fellows down there that played music, and a lot of them that had played with me at some time. And, of course, when I tried to go in there, well, they'd want me to play with them. And that's how I got back into it. If it hadn't been for that, why... You probably never would have heard me play. Of course, you wouldn't have been missing anything, but...
So, about what year was that again when you got back into it?
Well, let's see, I came back out of the service, I don't know, it probably was... probably somewhere around the middle 40s. It was, I think maybe it was probably probably about the time that the war ended.
And you think you've haven't laid it down for any length of time since then.
No, I've played pretty regular. I've played less in the last since we were on that trip, since you and Mike and I were on that trip. Mm-hmm. I haven't played very much since that. Mm-hmm. I've played a little bit out, helped them out a little bit at the dances a few times when I'd be at the dance, where I'd maybe play two or three sets, but there used to be quite a few people to come in and play, and when they was doing that, I was, of course, playing whenever anybody come in, but there haven't been very many in to play, and I don't know, I kind of hate to sit down and play by myself. If I'm playing with somebody where I don't have to listen to myself so much, it sounds all right, but if I play by myself, it's...
Oh, yeah. Got run out of this side.